Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, April 12th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Alex Garland's latest film, Civil War, and also we're going to share an interview with Alex Garland himself. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer Bill Bria.
Greetings, Earthlings.
Welcome back, Bill. I thought it would be fun to talk to you about this new movie from Alex Garland. I think we can, if we can set it up this way, I'd like to do like a little bit of a spoiler-free sort of broad conversation in the very beginning, and then we can get into some spoiler stuff, and then we'll share an interview that Jacob did with Alex Garland in the back half of this show. So I guess let's kick things off. Just general thoughts, sort of broad, big picture takeaways. What did you think about this movie, Bill?
Yeah, I think Civil War is easily one of the most visceral movies to come down the line in a long time, in terms of in totality as an experience in the cinema. It is something that I didn't necessarily think could still happen, in the sense that I, as a big horror fan, as a big movie fan in general, as kind of a sicko myself, I didn't think I could be as shaken by a movie as I was by this one. But I was, and it's again, because I'm a sicko, it thrilled me instead of put me off. but it's something where I didn't realize until maybe 24 hours after seeing it that I was having still such a kind of a unconscious or subconscious physical reaction to being in that, however long the film is, 2-hour experience. Mm-hmm. I know that our colleague Ryan Scott has mentioned in a piece he just wrote recently about the way that the sound mix works in this movie. The gunfire itself is just aligned to give you, the audience member, the most, and realistic is maybe not the right word. It's hyper real. It's that feeling of like you're in the middle of these, you know, battles, these skirmishes, as the characters, our protagonists, who are journalists, are, and at no point is it intending to be, let's say, a hardcore Henry style POV experience, and yet it really is immersive in a similar way, in terms of like you're not necessarily seeing it through the exact eyes of a character or meant to experience it as like, you know, a video game or a 3D movie at all. Mm-hmm. And yet it still, I think, retains a lot of the power of those first person experiences in terms of putting you in the middle of a situation. And part of it, and we'll get into this obviously in the spoiler section too, but part of it is the ambiguity inherent in the movie, which is absolutely intentional, is part and parcel of putting you, the audience member, on so much of that edge, you know, for mm-hmm. so long. Because the less context you have as a person, the more unsettling it is. And that's all feeding into this, you know, this realm that Garland puts you into. So it's a deliberately alienating, or not alienating, maybe as much as aggressively needling experience.
Yeah.
And it's something that obviously it's not going to be for everyone. So what was your take on it, Ben?
I literally just got out of the theater, like 10 minutes ago. So wow. I'm like kind of, I honestly couldn't even really tell you if I liked the movie yet or not, because it's a lot. I mean, as you know, you've seen the movie. Anybody yeah. who sees this movie will be able to tell you. It is a lot. And especially like just walking out of it, that kind of shaken feeling that you alluded to, that's my primary emotion right now. I'm not quite sure what I make of it as like an intellectual exercise or any of that yet. I'm still just like experiencing it on that visceral level. But I can tell you like one specific thing that made an impact on me. And that is that I found there to be a real artistry to the construction of the movie that you really feel as a viewer. And what I mean by that is there's artistry in the construction of every movie. The script transitions from one scene to the next. The editing cuts from one scene to the next, blah, blah, blah. But most of the time, you're not really asked to think about those transitions. And here, Alex Garland and his team of collaborators, they really underline several sequences by transitioning from moments of almost serenity to extreme chaos, just dropping you straight into the middle of a shootout or a firefight or something like that with really no warning. And there's like a deliberate choice there to sort of shock you awake as an audience member and keep you on your toes, but also like a, this sort of artistic choice that fits in with the themes that he's exploring here, you know, the perils of war and the extremity of violence and the fact that bullets don't really recognize lines on a map and all of that stuff too. So I just was really drawn to and impressed by the way that the movie chose how to drop you from one scene into another, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it makes total sense. And I think that you're hitting upon something that is really unique to this film. Maybe not wholly unique. I know that some of Garland's touchstones that he's mentioned in the press several times, including, I think, Jacob's interview, at least at one point, is, you know, he'll talk about stuff like, of course, Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket, Coppola's Apocalypse Now, and Klimov's Come and See from 1985, the Soviet anti-war film, all of which have their moments, or in Come and See's case, entirety, of just being really oppressively upsetting. And, you know, it's taking away what I think a lot of us tend to assume about the war film, which is, yeah, you're expecting in any general, you know, given war film, you're not expecting to go in super jazzed about seeing people getting shot or, you know, blown up or anything, because usually even the most jingoistic war film has an element of war is hell, it's not that great, da da da. And this, you know, really goes a step further than a lot of war films we've been used to in the last, you know, couple decades, even if not, you know, longer than that, which is repositioning it to be the most horrific experience possible. And I, yeah, again, speaking as I would consider myself primarily a horror fan, you know, with the horror genre, there is that unspoken tenet between audience and filmmaker of like, you know, you're here to get scared. We know you're here to get scared. So it's going to be a little bit of a haunted house kind of fun thing. Maybe we'll push your boundaries, but maybe not too far sort of thing. I feel like there's maybe a social contract with the war film that American or Western audiences haven't really been exposed to as much. And this really recontextualizes that.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Okay. So I want to, there's so many like spoilery things that I want to talk to you about. Anything else that we should mention before we dive into spoilers, like any last, I guess, last calls for people who might not, or might be like on the fence about whether or not they should see this. What would you say to people like that?
I would say absolutely know your limits in terms of how much, you know, seeing images upsets you in terms of violence, in terms of visceralness, in terms of obviously, I think honestly something you should consider is lack of context. If it's going to upset you that you don't quite have the lines demarcated in this movie about who are the quote unquote good guys and bad guys, who are even the conflicts, you know, people involved in the war itself, you know, if that's going to be too upsetting to you, then you probably don't want to have this experience. But if it's intriguing, if it's thought provoking, if it's something that you want to go into, I think you're going to come out shaken maybe, but ultimately thrilled to really have such a unique experience at the cinema that I again, I'd have to go back to those films I mentioned earlier, you know, in terms of having something with this context and this genre, you know, to come along in a while.
Yeah, it really does feel special that A24 put this movie out in the year 2024. I mean, I know that we have an election coming up and all of that, and that was kind of like what I was thinking of a lot when I saw the trailers for this movie of like, oh God, I don't know if I want to sit through this in an election year. But I will say, to the movie's credit, I didn't think really that much about our modern political landscape very much. I was right. Very immersed in this world and this sort of alternate reality that Garland had created. Whereas before I was really dreading like, oh God, I'm going to be drawing parallels between this character and this real life figure and all that stuff. And I'll just say that for me, the movie was so effective that I kind of closed out. I mean, of course there are images and certain things that it's like inescapable to think about. But for the most part, I was very mesmerized by what he had here. So if that was a fear for you going in, like it was for me, take my experience with a grain of salt, but that's how I went into it and came out of it. So, okay, let's get into some spoilers stuff here, Bill. There's two scenes that I want to talk to you about. The Winter Wonderland sniper scene, I just found to be like incredibly tense. What a fantastic, just really small small scale, like piece of storytelling. I just thought that was like exceptionally well done. Did you have any thoughts about that scene?
Yeah, I love, again, there's a, I obviously would consider Garland a genre filmmaker. And typically up till now, he's dabbled mostly in science fiction, a little bit of horror as well. I think he's more, you know, the type to introduce horror elements into a science fiction premise rather than the other way around. But one of the aspects of that scene that's so great is the perverseness of how it is incredibly tense. It's incredibly claustrophobic, and yet it's taking place in this huge open field in bright, broad daylight. Mm-hmm. So it has the incongruity that the rest of the film has as a theme, but maybe that's the scene that's best of the best visual exposition of that incongruity, where in normal life, you would look at that setting and go, oh, I'm fairly safe here. And, you know, it couldn't be further from the truth. Even the fact that it's decorated with all of these holiday, you know, Christmas trappings, yeah, which, you know, of course, is typically coded as, oh, here's comfort, here's warmth, here's home and hearth and present giving and cookies. And yet, you know, people are being sniped at. And the fact
and
that,
you don't even see the sniper, too. That speaks to what you're talking about before. Yeah.
He's a disembodied, almost omnipotent threat. And ultimately, when he or she, we have no idea, but this person is taken care of at the end of the scene so that our protagonists can continue their journey. You know, we never see their body. We never see how many of them there were. We assume it was just one. Mm-hmm. So it's this nebulous threat, which, again, is used in the scene, you know, to extrapolate, you know, this major theme of the movie, which is when Joel, when Wagner Moura's character, who is the more writer type of journalist, as opposed to Kirsten Dunst, you know, Lee Smith's photojournalist and Callie Spaney's as well. Joel asks, you know, these soldiers who are firing back at the sniper, like, well, how did this start? Like, who is that other person out there? Who are you guys? Who's representing what side? And they say essentially, you know, well, it doesn't matter. Like, we're trying to kill the person that's trying to kill us.
Right. Yeah. And it's almost like ideology has gone out the window. Like, it doesn't even really matter what they're fighting for at that point too, which I think is what the movie kind of focuses on as well. So, the Jesse Plemons thing, we got to talk about that. I mean, that scene is like so viscerally upsetting. And like, I mean, obviously there's like the real world. This is what I was talking about, where like, there are some aspects of this movie that you kind of can't put the real world out of your mind. And like, mm-hmm. You know, him asking people where they're from and all of that, and then just shooting these people. I mean, it was just like so brutal and so upsetting to watch. And like, I can't, it's one of the most upsetting things I've seen in a long time on screen, Bill. I know that this movie is not like, you know, we talked about Eli Roth's Thanksgiving, where like, things like very over the top violence or whatever, but this is like disturbing in a very real way, and just kind of rattled me to my core seeing this scene. So what did you think about this?
There, I'm going to pull from my real life here. There was a moment when I moved from where I used to live or grew up as a young kid, and then moved with my family to Michigan to grow up the rest of the way in third grade. And actually, this might have been second grade, so I'll cut that part out. So in second grade, there was a kid. He came up to me on the playground one day. We had never met, this kid and I, never interacted before at all. And this kid, point blank, just said to me on the playground one day, "You owe me $5. And at first I was like, well, that's ridiculous. We've never met before. I don't have any standing debts with you. I don't owe you any money. And he said, "Now you owe me $10. And I'm like, why is it going up? What's happening here? Am I suddenly on the hook for $10? I don't have $10. Where am I going to get $10? And he said, "Now you owe me $15. So for him, it was this kind of sick, sadistic little playground game. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, at that time, I, as the victim, did not know how real he was playing it in terms of like, did he really expect me to give him money? Was he just trying to tease me and get me upset? So watching this Jesse Plemons scene, it had that connotation for me of like, when you as a supposedly rational, logical human being are dealing with someone who is operating on a completely different level of rational and logic for them. Mm-hmm. You know, if for us rational people, he seems totally insane, of course, but he also has that conviction that the insane tend to have, which is, I'm operating on my own set of rules. You don't know what those rules are. So at any point you could make the wrong move and then it's over for you. Cause I have all the power and the, you know, the death here. And it is, yeah, easily the most terrifying I think I've seen Plemons. It's like his Breaking Bad character turned up to, you know, 20. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah. And I think also, like, obviously the racial dynamics at play, you know, you and I are a couple white guys sitting here on this podcast talking about it. Oh, yeah. So we're going to have a different experience than a lot of other people who watch this movie. And I mean, fortunately for us, unfortunately for society at large, this scene is going to resonate in a much different way with a lot of other people too. So, you know, we gotta underline that for sure. But
it's taking place, the entire scene takes place next to a mass grave, which eventually, you know, Jesse's character falls into and has to experience that uncanny valley of like, I'm with these corpses and yet I'm not, and yet am, you know, that strangeness as well. It's in a movie full of upsettingly visceral scenes, it might be the most.
Yeah. The aftermath of that scene too is so important, I think, because you see the consequences of like the truly evil actions of that Jesse Plemons character and how they kind of ripple through people, like Kaylee Spaney's character throwing up in the car. And then of course, Stephen McKinley Henderson's character is shot and ultimately dies from that. But like, there's, you know, I think the movie does a good job of not just making it feel episodic. I mean, the movie does feel episodic in some ways. You know, there's this little adventure that they have, and then they go to like the stadium, which kind of feels like a little bit of a sanctuary, and they have some bonding moments, and then they move on to this, and it does feel like they are going from A to B and hitting dots along the way. But I think by showing the immediate aftermath of the scene and not just cutting away and picking up the action hours or days later or whatever, I think that really contributes to the power of the scene, right? Like by really like sitting in that moment and letting these characters feel the experience and the wave, the aftershocks almost of what they just went through.
Oh yeah. And I was going to say, really, when you mentioned, when you mentioned Spaney, Jesse vomiting in the car afterwards, I remember watching it for the first time thinking in the back of my mind, that's maybe the most realistic vomit scene I've ever seen in a movie ever.
Yeah.
Which is a dubious honor, but you know, it certainly speaks to how verisimilitude-ish this movie is in terms of, I know I just made up that word, it's fine, but it's something that, you know, had that moment been just a little bit more inauthentic or, you know, plastic in terms of the usual thing we're used to with vomiting on screen, where it's like, oh yeah, it's the pea soup or, you know, whatever. It had that resonance of like, oh God, that really just happened.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels human in a way. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm trying to think of, I know we don't really have a ton of time to get into like a beat by beat breakdown of this movie or anything. I want to talk to you about like what this movie is actually about, and like what you think your read on what Garland is trying to say here might be. Before we get to that though, I just wanted to open the floor to you and see if there were any other scenes that you wanted to shout out or moments that you wanted to highlight, anything like that, before we get into sort of like the closing of our conversation here.
Yeah, well, I think I'll use it as a gateway into this final topic, which is one of the, I think, maybe the most surprising scene when first watching the film, but in retrospect is not at all surprising that it's included, is what I would call the Oasis scene, where kind of in the middle of the film, kind of in the middle of their journey, they come upon, they being the journalists that are traveling from New York City to DC in the press van. That's the general scope of the movie's road movie journey. In the middle of that, they come across this town, which, unlike everything else that they've been seeing and will be seeing later on, where, you know, the America has been turned into a war zone, you know, not unlike what we're used to seeing in sort of a post-apocalyptic movie of just, you know, cars strewn around the highway, abandoned and all that stuff. In the middle of that, they've come across this town which looks completely harmless. It's, you know, kind of almost 1950s perfect, and it's, you know, manicured lawns and everything, and people blissfully going about their days. And they end up at a dress shop on Main Street of that town. And Joel, you know, again, wanting to interview people, speaks to the the woman at the desk manning the shop and says, you know, don't you know there's a civil war going on out there? And do you guys, are you aware of what's happening? I mean, are you okay? Like, what's, he's kind of trying to fish about, like, how is this possible? And the woman is essentially just shrugging and saying, yeah, well, you know, yeah, we've heard about it. We just kind of keep out of it, you know? Mm-hmm. And not only if you take this movie as, say, you know, a modernized version of even, you know, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which, you know, Apocalypse Now is a loose remake of, or mm-hmm. adaptation of, you have typically in your survivalist story, whether it's in a jungle or a desert, you know, this moment where, or you know, if you're at sea, there's the sirens on the rock who are calling you, you know, to a more blissful state or something. You have this element of the journey where you're, you know, thinking that maybe you can get off the boat and escape and not worry about all the issues that you have to deal with in the rest of your journey or the rest of your life. And not only does this have a connotation in our obviously real lives, in this society, this country, in terms of ignorance is bliss and all of that aspect mm-hmm. to it, but it's also it's an uncanny valley on top of an uncanny valley, because, and this is getting into the larger topic you wanted to get to in terms of what Garland's doing with this movie and what I think it's about. I think Garland as an artist, as a filmmaker, is someone who is always looking to transform the normal or the average or the assumed into the uncanny. He's looking to create a liminal space out of something that we tend to assume is average or you know, not even worth mentioning. So mm-hmm. obviously there's really some obvious, really, you know, huge examples of that, like 28 Days Later being, you know, the movie that kind of resurged the zombie subgenre, even though they're not zombies, quote unquote, but whatever, we'll get to that. That's another debate. But, it, you know, turning London into a post-apocalyptic state, and, you know, even the fact that Danny Boyle, the director of that movie, was shooting with DV cameras, making everything look really grainy and immediate and visceral, you know, was that movie's version of, you know, turning the familiar into the unfamiliar. And then you have something like Annihilation, which I think is strangely this movie's closest antecedent in his filmography, where you have this group of people venturing willingly into a strange land that they have to somehow understand and survive through and document mm-hmm. and you know, and just observe, really, in order to figure out if there's any sort of coexistence going forward, you know, between yeah. the old world and this new world.
Yeah, so, 100%.
Yeah. So I really think that Garland, I mean, there's been a lot of, obviously, you're going to see a lot of debate continue over this weekend, if not the next several months or years, depending on how long it stays in the conversation, about what this movie's relationship is to, you know, modern day politics, what this movie's relationship is to America itself. I don't know how much Garland was really conceiving of that. And I know Jacob's interview, what he says in that interview goes into a little bit of that as well. I think he was interested in giving Americans in particular, but just the world in general, an experience that they're not really at all used to, which is most movies about America as a war-torn country tend to have that element of genre to them. It's aliens, it's zombies, it's, you know, vampires, whatever, a metaphor essentially for what we have seen in other countries, you know, in the past and even modern day, you know, even mm-hmm. still. So it's giving us privileged Americans the experience of what if our country was like those. It's not necessarily a comment on, like, whether that's, you know, good, evil, you know, right wing, left wing. It's just sort of this, you know, here's what we haven't had to deal with yet, and we may have to in the future. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that goes back to it being, like, designed to be kind of an upsetting experience, you know, on Garland's yeah. part. For me, like, in some ways, I feel like this is a movie kind of about passing, like, about a passing of the torch almost between generations, and how, like, even on a smaller yeah. scale, that can be a violent thing. Like, institutional knowledge can be passed down, but there can be personal and individual human costs to that. Like, in this movie, there's literal violence, you know, with the gunfire and all that kind of stuff, but it can apply to a bunch of different fields and jobs. And maybe it's just because this movie is about journalists, but I thought a lot about our industry and, like, the tumultuous changes that it's gone through in the past handful of years, most of which have been terrible.
Big time.
And, like, the violence that those changes have wrought on many of our former colleagues and friends. And I think this movie is kind of, it's big enough to work as this straightforward surface level thriller about journalists trying to track down a president, interview him during this conflict. But it's also big enough, I think, to contain all sorts of different interpretations and readings into it. And like the passing of the torch between Kirsten Dunst's character, who's Kirsten Dunst is great, by the way. We haven't really said
We
haven't really had a ton of time to talk much about the performances. And unfortunately, we're running very low on time, so we don't have time to really get into it, but she's awesome. Her, you know, the passing of the torch between her to Kayleigh Spaney and that the arc of that character or that dynamic and how that plays out in this movie, that stuck out to me as like one of the big talking points or one of the big sort of thematic explorations that he was getting into here. But I feel like Garland is one of the best modern filmmakers at making movies that people can talk about and have reads on and have takes on that are like wildly different and still feel like you're right and justified in thinking that way. You know, like there are a lot of directors just make movies that don't have the space for that kind of stuff. And I feel like Alex Garland goes out of his way to put the space into his movie. So I always appreciate that from him.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think one of the dissonance that people have trouble with him is the fact that he is so deliberately open in that way. Ambiguous is another word I guess you could use. And it's something that we're not used to with our auteurs, you know, where usually when you think of an auteur, you think, oh, they have such a huge, specific, particular view on the world and people and, you know, their characters and their genres and their tones. And I think there's a lot of consistency in Garland in the way that most auteurs have that consistency to them and their work. And yet, as you just said, there's so much room to put yourself in there, the individual viewer. And, you know, that's going to be frustrating for some.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, Alex Garland can be kind of a prickly interview subject. I interviewed him several years ago for Annihilation, and he was somewhat intimidating, but I think Jacob had a really good conversation with him, and there were some really good observations and anecdotes in this that I'm going to be thinking about for quite some time. So here is Jacob's interview with Alex Garland.
So Civil War feels like, to me, a historical film from an alternate universe where it kind of expects you already understand the basics of the war, kind of like how Saving Private Ryan or Dunkirk don't need to tell you how World War II started.
Right.
Do you view it this way, or is that, or how would you come about with this perspective?
I think you could extrapolate how this came about from bits of information contained within the film. Personally, I also think that the film doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes out of a sense of anxiety about the nature of populist politics and division and extremist behavior, as well as extremist thinking. And I think that's pretty shared, actually. I think a lot of people feel that, and they have their own internal sense that they already arrive with about why that exists. Now, people might not agree that their versions of account of how that might exist might differ, but the anxiety, I think, is quite broadly shared. And so I'm also relying on people's own sense of a situation as well as things that are marked within the film itself.
Yeah, I think one of the more surprising things about the film is I think some people, myself included, may have expected the premise to lead to more grandstanding, but instead the film kind of exists in an almost, I don't want to say neutral place, but a place where the suggestion is that once the violence starts, once the bullets are flying, the reasons don't matter as much because people are dying. Was that always your intention, that once the war starts, that no longer matters?
It's partly that. That's definitely part of it. It's. I think it's true that sometimes combat, it loses its reasons to exist quite quickly and then becomes just about things like staying alive or not being killed or killing the person who's trying to kill you, and it can just fold down into that state. But there's there's something else, actually, on a personal level, there's something else, which is really to do with journalism. And it's to do with, this is a product partly of me being middle-aged, I think, but it's to do with an old-fashioned form of journalism, which was reporting. And bias in the terms that you mean it, which I think grandstanding implies bias, that was not permitted within a certain kind of news reporting as an ideological position, the ideology being connected to a belief within journalism that journalism needed to be trusted. And so if it was overtly propagandist, it would be defeating its own aims. And its aims were societal. It was to be a check and a balance and holding a government to account. And in order to hold a government to account when a government is corrupt, which governments will do, they will at times be very corrupt. And in order to hold them to account, you have to be trusted. So that has certainly been eroded. It's been eroded because it's been under attack deliberately by politicians who seek to erode it for their own reasons. I think also social media has accelerated and changed the terms and the space in which journalism sits. But it's also because many journalistic institutions have completely abdicated that responsibility and have tilted hard towards bias, which means tilting hard towards propaganda. And they do that because they're trying to maintain an audience, and the audience needs to be maintained as a relationship with advertising, so money. And a consequence of that, there are various consequences, but one of them is they might be trusted by the choir they're preaching to, but they're not trusted by any of the other choirs. And so a generalized sense of distrust in journalism starts to exist. So I that concerns me. I don't like it. I grew up around journalists. I know they can be spiky or conflicted or compromised or any number of different things, but that we really need them. And there's a difference between the role they play and what they might be like as individuals. They're just not the same thing. And I want to trust journalists. So the film attempts to function like old-fashioned reporters. And in a way, what old-fashioned reporters would do, not that they don't exist anymore, they do, it's just they exist surrounded by this noise which diminishes their traction. What they would do is, in a sense, say, this is what I observed. And then it would be up to the reader in the old days, or the viewer, to take their own meaning from that. But what they didn't do was distrust what the journalist was saying they observed. Do you see what I mean? I don't know if I'm clear in that. But
you are, and that reminds me of some of the moments in the movie that really stuck out to me, where the journalist characters are seen, you know, interacting with characters from all sides of the conflict. They share cigarettes, they embed themselves. There's no sense of this is the team we're rooting for. It's a sense of this is where the story is, we're going to follow it.
Exactly, because as journalists, they would be abstracting themselves from rooting. They're not interested in rooting. They're actually, in fact, one of them comments on this at a certain point. Like, what we do is observe it so other people are asking questions in a certain kind of way. So the film is attempting to function something like that.
Yeah, I think one thing that helps your case here is that you've talked about this in various Q&As and interviews already about the idea of not romanticizing the war, and I think and not making it feel exciting. There really is a horror element to how the gunfights and the battle sequences play out, especially in the sound design. I would love to know the conversations you had in post with your sound designers and mixers to guarantee that those bullets never sounded exciting. They always sounded terrifying.
I'm actually very pleased you said that. The answer is that a gun sound is, in a way, terrifying. A modern automatic rifle or machine gun or 50 caliber machine, whatever it happens to be, these are machines that are constructed to kill. That is what they're there for. And they do this in this incredibly efficient fashion. And there is something sinister in the noise of something that really only exists for that purpose. And so what we did was we used exactly those noises. We used guns that fired blanks, and we put full flash blanks in them, and we recorded that noise as faithfully as we could. That will include the sound of the gun, but also the way it reacts with objects around it. A huge effort in the film related to reality and the grammar of either lived experience or news photography or documentaries. And we were doing that in many, many ways throughout the film, but hugely to do with sound design. And where something happened that meant a bit of recorded noise didn't work for one reason or another, it can be to do with the distortion, it spikes too much, it fritzes or whatever, we would then just record real guns firing and use that. So film sometimes will do little tricks to do with using sub bass or extra noises. And what those extra sounds do is they slightly distance you from the stark, aggressive sound of an automatic weapon firing. That film has a way sometimes of being subtly reassuring within the context of action or violence. And what we did was, where possible, tried to remove those reassurances as much as possible.
Throughout your filmography, there's this ongoing interest in the transformation and mutation of people, nature, technology. And in Civil War, where it's a transformation or mutation of an entire nation and society, do you see this as a direct correlation or extension on your previous ideas, or do you view this as something new entirely?
That's an interesting question. I think it probably relates to all of the others. And I think that the only thing is I'd probably frame it slightly differently in my own mind, for whatever that's worth, which is, it's more about how subjective everything is, that we perceive it as being objective because we're seeing through our eyes and we're having our responses, and we attribute truth to those things, sort of factual reality to those things. But I think everything is just much more subjective than it seems to be. And actually, polarization is in a way a demonstration of that. Because I think sometimes people in polarized states are not actually, I'm not talking about everybody, I'm talking about some people within polarized states, are not exactly bad people. They are just people who cannot conceptualize the other side of the argument. And that is a consequence of subjectivity, if you see what I mean. And so what I'm trying to do often is walk towards subjectivity because I think it's there and sort of exist within it. So scenes in films that I make that might seem very surreal or dreamlike or strange, I think are in a way representations of reality, however strange that might sound. I can give an example of it in Civil War, where there's a scene in Civil War that takes place around a bunch of abandoned Christmas decorations from like a Christmas fair, which looks like a self-conscious bit of surrealism that has been created by a production designer and inserted into the film. But actually, we found all that stuff abandoned in a field about 100 yards from where we shot it. We just dragged it 100 yards further up the road for various reasons. And that thing, you're driving through Georgia in early summer, and then you find a bunch of abandoned Christmas stuff, a polar bear and a penguin, and a weird box that has mannequins in it that is loosely set up to look like maybe a nativity scene or something like that, is the weirdness of real life. And so it's not a bit of surrealism, it's a bit of realism, bizarrely, you know.
Without going into, like, I don't want to spoil the film for anybody who's reading this or hearing it before, so I'll dance lightly here. But in a way, this film is building toward what feels like the most famous photograph in this fictional history. The film's climax is about a photograph and about a photograph that everybody in this alternate universe has seen. Every history textbook has seen all over the news. Everybody knows it. Was this always the intention to build toward a photograph that has the weight of something that feels like it was monumental?
Do you know what? I wish I could say yes, because that's such a smart idea. It would be such a sort of neat resolution to the film in a kind of themic way. That had never occurred to me until you stated it. I was just showing war photographers doing what they do, or actually just press photographers doing what they do. And because they're good at what they do, they capture iconic moments. That's a much more elegant version of that. And it would be, I would love to lay claim to that. I'd love to be able to say that, but I can't, because I'd be bullshitting. But, what can I say?
Well, you can have it. It's yours now. So we've got time for one more question. And
do you know what? I'm just going to say it's not mine, it's yours. And that is one of the things that really interests me in this subjective thing, in this offering up narratives and people bringing themselves to the narrative. That is actually a perfect example of what I'm talking about. And if I do anything as a filmmaker, I do deliberately leave space for that. I know it's going to happen anyway. When I say I lean towards subjectivity, that is the thing I'm leaning towards, is to do with space, to do with leaving imaginative or thoughtful areas for someone to inhabit. But anyway, sorry, what was the last question?
Oh, all good. That's great. My last question, maybe a smidge off topic, but it's, you know, I'm curious about, now there's been some distance from its release, your previous film, Men. I'm a fan, and I know reaction was mixed, and I'm wondering if enough time has passed for you to process the reception and how people reacted to that film, because I know people had very big opinions on it. I'm curious how you feel about it after some time's passed.
The truth is with that, is that ever since I started working, which was a book, it was a novel, it wasn't a film, called The Beach. Number one, this difference between the intention of something and the way it's received was made really clear to me, because I wrote a book that in my mind was sort of, it was various things, but it was also slightly critical of a backpacker scene. And then I could see it was being treated as a celebration. And that was made very clear to me very early. But the other thing that was made clear to me was, before writing it, I would have anticipated something like a sense of ownership or pride or a reward as an internal state from having done something like written a book. That's what I would have imagined happened. And I have a very clear memory of walking into a bookshop after it was published with the intention of seeing it. That's why I was going into the bookshop. And then seeing it in the bookshop and expecting something to happen where I felt affected in some ways. I imagine I would have guessed pride. But I felt completely neutral. I felt absolutely nothing at all. I was quite dismayed by it. And quite surprised, actually, and that's never left me. I think it's a personality quirk. I work really hard on something. I really care about it while I'm doing it, I get obsessive. Actually, I get very, very obsessive about the thing while I'm doing it. Can't really escape from it. The moment it walks out into the world, I feel very divorced from it. It could easily be made by someone else. So when you ask me about Men, about how I see it now, it fits into that category, which is the same category as all of the other things. They're a product of a fixation. And I think I've been lucky in my working life that I've been able to not really worry about commercial considerations too much. And I've been allowed by financiers to make some slightly odd projects that don't on the face of them make sense. So I feel very fortunate, but also quite separate, because the fever's broken. At the point it's done, it's like the fever breaks, something like that.
All right, well, I'm out of time. Thank you so much. Congratulations on the film, and I hope you have a rest of the day. It goes great.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, Bill, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. Where can people find you and more of your work on the internet?
I can be found on my Slash Film page, Bill Bria, slashfilm.com/Bill Bria. And all my socials are at Bill Bria. So check me out on Twitter. I'm not going to say X. Instagram and TikTok.
Okay, excellent. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features that you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. That's bpearson@slashfilm.com. Please leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all on Monday.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.